No? Everybody? Everybody's good? All right. Awesome. We're going to be in Jeremiah chapter 33. Jeremiah chapter 33. The hugglers are on my right. I won't even know where to talk to anymore this morning. Everyone's moving around on me. Jeremiah chapter 33 this morning. Now, this is a different message from last week, but it's set in the same instance as the message from last week. But he initiates a new conversation with Jeremiah, but it's very much connected with where Jeremiah has been. To summarize very shortly, Jeremiah has been talking about all of the sin of the people, and he's been talking about the consequences of the sin of the people. And so generally, Jeremiah, and as a whole, is a very negative flavored book. And the people don't like to hear the message. It's not comfortable. It's not easily swallowed. And so they're rejecting it. They're pushing it away. The princes, the priests, the prophets, and all the rest of the people, they don't want to hear Jeremiah's message. So they're slandering Jeremiah. They're having plots against Jeremiah. They're trying to get rid of Jeremiah. And Jeremiah's continuing to preach the truth. However, right here, couched in the middle, Jeremiah 30 through 33, which is where we are now, he talks about a different topic, and he focuses away from the consequences of their sin and focuses on the hope that God still has for Israel. And he does this in two ways. He does this about the immediate consequences. They're going to go into captivity. That's happening. But they will be gone for 70 years, and then they will return, and there is hope for our land. In spite of the fact that they're leaving, they will come back. But then he also focuses on the far future. He focuses on the end of the story. Jerusalem and Israel and Judah doesn't have a temporary storyline. Their story will last until the end of time. And he says, even at the end of this story, after greater tribulation, I will bring great restoration. After great mourning in the future, I will bring great joy. Because I will change your hearts. I will do a new work. And through a new work that I will do, instead of taking the law from the outside in, I will change your hearts from the inside out. And so that's what he's promising. And what he does in the last chapter, Jeremiah 32, is he tests to see how much Jeremiah truly believes this. Jeremiah's been preaching that the land has hope, but is he willing to invest in hope? And so last week, when he was in prison, months before Babylon's about to take over the land completely, God tells him to buy a piece of property in Israel right next to Jerusalem. Almost as a test to see whether or not he thinks this land is worth anything. And Jeremiah does. And after he does, he obeys first and asks questions later. After he does, he asks God and he says, Babylon is right outside. And then you tell me to buy a piece of property. And God says to him, yes, because this land will flourish again. And there will be hope again. And there will be playing in the streets again. And there will be land bought in this land again. And you will be the first one to invest in it, Jeremiah. Do you believe that God can do the impossible? Then invest in it today when I tell you to. Now, last week I made this one side point. One of my points was that we can invest in the hope of what seems to be completely and utterly broken because God's power justifies that decision. Jeremiah pointed out how bleak it looked, and Jeremiah was correct. Everything he said in that chapter was factually accurate. Babylon was outside. They did have mounts right out the city. He did know they were going to fall. This was not going to be like Assyria where they were all going to go away this time because of God's power. God said that's not happening. And so everything Jeremiah said was true. He said, yes, that's true now, but I can still do the impossible with it. My power justifies you investing in the hope of a broken people. And so he continues that same stream in Jeremiah chapter 33. And so while he's still in prison, remember Jeremiah is in prison for preaching the truth. While he's still there at the beginning, I'm going to read the first five verses in our introduction today. Verse 1. Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto Jeremiah the second time, while he was yet shut up in the court of the prison, saying, thus saith the Lord, the maker thereof, the Lord that formed it to establish it, the Lord is his name. Call unto me, and I will answer thee, and show thee great and mighty things which thou knowest not. For thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, concerning the houses of the city, concerning the houses of the kings of Judah, which are thrown down by the mounts and by the sword. They come to fight with the Chaldeans, but to fill them with the dead bodies of men, whom I have slain in mine anger and in my fury, and for all those whose wickedness I have hid my face from this city. In this interesting, very short passage at the beginning of this section, God comes to Jeremiah and tells him, right after he told him to buy this piece of property, he says, thus saith the Lord, I am the maker of it. I formed it and I established it. What? He's the maker. He's the former. He's the establisher of what? Well, it'd be really easy to just say, of all creation, because that would be a normal motif for God to have in a message. I am the maker of heavens and earth, therefore obey me. That would have been a normal thing for him to say. But that's not what he says here. He just says, I am the maker. I am the former. I am the establisher. I am the one who does it. What it? What he's been talking about. He just told to Jeremiah, I can restore these broken people. And I will be the maker of it. I will be the establisher of it. I will be the former of it. I am the one who's doing this plan, not you. You can't do it. These people can't do it. And what he does is he contrasts his ability with the ability of the people in this passage. And what is so important, and that's the title of my message this morning, is he is the maker. He is the one who does it and not us. And that's true of anything that we can have hope in. The problem with the idea of hope is we usually use the concept of hope as a very empty emotional motivation where we think positively about what could be, but it's empty to the extent that we have no reason to think that it's possible. Like, there could be hope for my family because I want there to be. There could be hope for my life because I want there to be. There could be hope for my marriage because I want there to be. But that's an empty emotional motivation. Nothing has changed. I've just given positive feedback to myself. But what he says to Jeremiah is there's hope for your nation because I can make it so, not you. God is the maker of it. That's true in our spiritual life. God tells us that all throughout the New Testament. I gave you a passage from 1 Thessalonians. At the end of 1 Thessalonians, it's funny, he kind of concludes with a bunch of spitfire commands. Pray without ceasing. And everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus concerning you. Quench not the spirit. Despise not prophesyings. Prove all things. Hold fast to that which is good. So it's just a bunch of things you need to work on. And then he says this in verse 23, and the very God of peace sanctify you wholly, wholly, completely. And I pray, God, your whole spirit and soul and body be preserved blameless unto the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. Look at verse 24. Faithful is he that calleth you, who also will do it. Pray without ceasing. Give thanks. Don't quench the spirit in your life. Because God wants you to be set apart to him completely, all of you. But God is faithful to you that if he asked you to do it, if we obey, his power will be the one that accomplishes it. We have, a lot of our Christian thinking comes with good, positive self-motivation to be the maker of our own spiritual progress. And that's why we're very frustrated. That's why we think religion doesn't work, because we tried to be the maker of it, and it didn't work. So he says, I will do it. To Jeremiah, he says it to us. So I just preached this to the teenagers on Wednesday, Psalm 37. The steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord, and he delighteth in his way. If I am a good man, and he describes what that means in that chapter at the beginning, I put my delight in the Lord. I trust him enough to do good. I live in righteousness and judgment in my life. That's what my life describes. If I am a good man, then God will order my steps. It's my responsibility to fear God and keep his commandments. It's God's responsibility to take care of all the things that I can't touch because I don't have control over them. Look what he says in verse 3. So if I believe that, verse 3, call unto me, and I will answer thee and show thee great and mighty things which thou knowest not. If I believe that God is the maker of those things, of progress, of possibility, if I believe that God is the maker, then I'm going to ask him to be the maker of those things. And then I will see things that I wouldn't have believed. The thing is, the reason why we don't ask God for help in our life is because we think that we're the maker of things, so we don't ask God to do it. We don't ask him to work in our life. We don't ask him to help us. And that's why we're not seeing it, because we're still relying on ourselves. That's why he says in Matthew 7, ask and it shall be given unto you. Seek and ye shall find. Knock and it shall be opened unto you. For if you ask, you receive. If you seek, you find. If you knock, and it shall be opened. But we don't. And that's why we don't see it. And then go back to verse 4 and 5. What he does now is he contrasts the people with him. He says this, thus saith the Lord, verse 4, the God of Israel, concerning the houses of the city, concerning the houses of the kings of Judah, which are thrown down by the mounts and by the sword. Babylon will throw down all these houses. They come to fight with the Chaldeans, but to fill them with the dead bodies of men whom I've slain in my anger and my fury. So that's what he says. He says, you know, your nation, they're going to want to save themselves. And so they will rush out of their city with their swords in their hands and with their shields trying to cover them up. And they will go to battle in all of their strength, and they will lose because they cannot save their nation. Only I can. They will fight and they will lose. Have you ever felt that way? You've tried really, really hard. You tried your best and you lost. You tried your hardest and you were unsuccessful. Have you ever felt that way in your Christian life? I was trying desperately to be like Christ on my own, and I felt like I was working uphill. And here he has at the beginning, I am the maker. Call unto me and I will do great and mighty things which you don't know. By the way, they're going to go fight out, and they're going to go out and they're going to fight and they're going to lose. Why does he put those two next to each other? Because that's often our story. We don't ask God for help. We try to do everything on our own, and that is our own destruction. When we try to save ourselves, we lose. God is the maker of it. So we have to trust God to be the maker of it and not trust ourselves to be the maker of it. Of what? Of our success. Of our plans, our goals, our dreams, our programs, our ministry. When we try to be the maker and the doer and the establisher and the former of it, then we will be discouraged because we will be fighting a losing battle. We are not strong enough to do God's work. We're only strong enough to be obedient through his power. When we let God be the maker of it, when we trust him and do right, then we will see great and mighty things that we don't know. So very quickly in this passage, as we walk through Jeremiah 33, hopefully my message will be short. It won't be, but I'm hoping that it will. But it's simple. So we're going to go through Jeremiah 33 and see five quick reasons why he says he is the maker and not us. Number one, he is the cleanser. He is the cleanser. Look at verse number 6. Behold, I will bring it health, talking about Jerusalem, this nation. I will bring it health and cure, and I will cure them and reveal unto them the abundance of peace and truth. And I will cause the captivity of Judah and the captivity of Israel to return, and will build them as at the first. And I will cleanse them from all their iniquity, whereby they have sinned against me, and I will pardon all their iniquities whereby they have sinned and whereby they have transgressed against me. The people transgressed, the people sinned, the people had iniquity, the people messed up. But I will cleanse them, God says. I will restore them. I will make them new. This broken nation, this failing nation that God will bring anger and fury on, he will be their health and their cure. Not them. They will not cure themselves. He will cure them. God will cleanse them from their iniquity. God will pardon their iniquities and their sin. God is the doer. God is the worker. He is the establisher of a better relationship with him. Not them. We get that in our mind. We think that we are the ones who makes ourselves right. We will become better. We will clean ourselves. Every world religion has been a continual story of people trying to cleanse themselves. And we can't even clean our Tupperware correctly, much less our own hearts. You ever have that? You know, you store spaghetti in a whatever Rubbermaid piece of, and then you microwave it, and it's red for the rest of eternity. And then you watch a YouTube video about them pouring a little bit of baking soda on it, and it wipes clean. Not for us. No, it is embedded now. That spaghetti sauce is now part of the molecular structure of my Tupperware. And we think, with our inability to even keep our own dishes clean, we think that we're going to go out into life and live spiritually and clean our own hearts. And this is what people do. Every mass that somebody goes to, every time they got to try to spin their prayer wheels or fast during Ramadan or knock on enough doors, all these religions are desperately trying to clean themselves. And the Bible describes to us in Isaiah 64:6 that our righteousnesses are as filthy rags. We can't clean ourselves. And that's why he says if we confess our sins, he is faithful to forgive our sins and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. And that's true of the unsaved person, but it's also true of the Christian who is saved. Well, if I go to church enough time and I join the choir and I serve in ministry, then I will be acceptable. But still, it is God that changes us, not us that changes us. To the Christian, he says in Philippians 2, I give you that passage, "Wherefore, my beloved, as ye have always obeyed, not in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." Well, there you go, Brother Nathan. It's my responsibility. I'm supposed to do it all. You're supposed to cooperate. You're supposed to obey. You're supposed to yield. Look at verse 13. "For it is God which worketh in you both to will and to do of his good pleasure." We need to continue to grow. We need to be diligent, like he says in 2 Peter 1, to add to our faith, virtue and knowledge and temperance and patience. But God is the one who is the worker. It is God that works in us. He is the cleanser. Number two, he is the restorer. He is the restorer. We don't make our lives new. He does. Look at verse 9 of Jeremiah 33. So talking about how he will cleanse them, he talks about the future of the city. "And it shall be to me a name of joy, a praise and an honor before all the nations of the earth, which shall hear all the good that I do unto them. And they shall fear and tremble for all the goodness and for all the prosperity that I procure unto it." What a great testimony that is. By the way, as a side note, there's a contrast there. You know, remember in all those previous chapters where he says, you will do the wrong thing, and then your nation will fall apart, and then you'll be a byword and a proverb and an astonishment to all the nations around you. As they walk by, they'll say, "What happened to Jerusalem?" Likewise, in this verse, he says, when I restore you, all the other nations will look at you and say, "Wow, look at all the good God has done unto them because of all the prosperity that I procure unto it." Look at verse 10. "Thus saith the Lord, again, there shall be heard in this place, which ye say shall be desolate, without man, without beast, even in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem that are desolate without man and without inhabitant, without beast." So that place that's completely broken down, in that place, verse 11, will be the voice of joy and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom, the voice of the bride, the voice of them that shall say, "Praise the Lord of hosts, for the Lord is good, for his mercy endureth forever." And of them that shall bring the sacrifice of praise into the house of the Lord. "For I will cause to return the captivity of the land as at the first, saith the Lord. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, again in this place, which is desolate, without man, without beast, and all the cities thereof shall be an habitation of shepherds, causing their flocks to lie down. In the cities of the mountains, and the cities of the vale, and in the cities of the south, and in the land of Benjamin, the places of Jerusalem, and in the cities of Judah, shall the flocks pass again under the hands of him that telleth them, saith the Lord." So everywhere there will be peace again. He gives this beautiful picture, and he says, look at this desolate, broken, destroyed city. Now, Babylon hadn't come for the third time yet, but their city was already plenty destroyed. Many people were already gone. All the craftsmen and all the princes and all of the leaders and all of the warriors were all gone. They had already stolen a lot of the stuff from the temple. So already there's desolation. He says, look at all of this. God can make it new again, where there's people playing in the streets and there's people singing again, and somebody actually chooses to plan a wedding here for their special day. This will be the one where they want to have it. He says, that is possible. But when we see the hope that's possible, the reaction is not to say, then I will do it. The reaction is to say, so I need to yield to God to do it. By the way, our fellows are going to come by in just a second with an offering plate. If you could just throw your attendance slip in, we'd appreciate that. Have you ever watched one of those home shows where they go up to this house that has a lot of potential? But the word potential means it's really beat up. That's what the word potential means. It has a lot of potential, but it is ugly and it has been neglected. But that's the point of the show. The point of the show is they're going to make it all fancy. And you know, that's one of the most dangerous shows, ladies, for your husband to watch. Because they make this whole house brand new and shiny and clean in like a half hour. Plus commercials. And so you're thinking, man, I could do that. That wasn't so hard. Of course, they take a video of all the progress and they turn it up to 100 times speed. So it looks like it goes really fast. And it's like, that didn't take very long at all. I mean, you know, just a little longer, I'm sure. And then your husband tries to do that thing that you've asked him to do 10 years ago. And he finally is getting to it. He's like, yes, we're going to make this work. The problem is your husband doesn't have the tools to do it. He has a couple tools, and they're all like, you know, the DIY Ryobi ones that he got for sale at the yard sale, and none of them actually do exactly what he needs to do, but he can make it work. He doesn't have the skills to do it because he did it that one time on that one job with his father-in-law when they did that thing, but that doesn't mean he's actually capable. So he doesn't have the tools to do it. He doesn't have the skills to do it. He doesn't have the resources to do it. When somebody's funding like $1 million into that show and you only have, you know, a couple thousand sitting in the bank that you don't want to use because you're going to save and skimp here and use the scrap pile in order to make it work. So you don't have the resources or the skills or the tools to do it, but you're going to make it happen. And then you end up calling the guy anyway to just finish the job once you're all done. Because you aren't necessarily as capable as we think we are. And the same is true about our life. It has potential. And we know that. But right now it's broken and neglected and ugly. Sometimes we feel like that way about our marriage. It has potential. But right now it's broken and neglected and ugly. We feel that way about our family. It's got potential. But right now it is broken and neglected and ugly. Our spiritual life has potential and we know it. But right now it is broken and neglected and ugly. And we just say, you know what? I can make this work. We can fix this. I think the problem is we don't have the resources or the tools or the wisdom to restore something. Just because it has potential doesn't mean that I can fix it. And that's what he says. Jerusalem has potential. The city's not a lost cause. There can be people playing in the streets again. There can be weddings had in the courtyard. There can be dancing. There can be praise. There can be singing. But he says, when you say, I will restore this land, you're going to fail. And that's what we do with our life time and time again, whether it's with ourselves, whether it's with our family, whether it's with our marriage. We say, I can restore it. And we're very disappointed because we don't have the capability to do that. God is the maker. God is the restorer. Number three, he is the good ruler. He is the good ruler. So after describing this new city that will be put back together, he describes their new king that will reign over them. Look at verse 14. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will perform that good thing which I promised unto the house of Israel and to the house of Judah. And in those days and at that time will I cause the branch of righteousness to grow up unto David, and he shall execute judgment and righteousness in the land. Somebody from David's line. We will have a Davidic king on the throne, but he will be a righteous one and will execute judgment. That means he will be just. They didn't have a just king for a while, making just choices. And righteousness, he will make the right decisions. A renewed nation can only function if it has a good king. If something is working and something's going somewhere, it's because of good leadership. I actually entered ministry when I was 15 years old when I started working at Chick-fil-A. And so that's where my first job was. And I was ministering to people with the fried chicken that we would serve. And so everybody knows Chick-fil-A is very top-notch when it comes to quick service. They don't like to be called fast food because of whatever. But we had a good boss. And you go to Chick-fil-A in the drive-thru, you know, you can sit in the drive-thru line like, you know, half a mile away and you still get your food in 7 minutes. It's crazy how fast they are. Everything is their pleasure and they're happy to get it. And when I worked there, we would always be smiling. We were supposed to be, at least. We did second mile service where we were supposed to come by and fill your drink and take your trash. And everything went really smoothly. You go to McDonald's, it's not the same way. And that's because the leadership is differently. You have teenagers coming off the streets, applying to the jobs, and yet you have two completely different structures. Why? Because the leadership is going in different directions. If you have something that's working, you have something that's leading them there. Pick a family that you love. Like, you just like the family. They love each other. They love other people. They're kind. They're respectful. They're just a good family. What's going to be true in that family is strong leadership. A family doesn't just happen to be a loving, faithful, growing, respectful family. Someone is leading the family. Authoritarian leadership is not strong leadership. That's not what I mean. But someone is leading them somewhere if they are going somewhere. And the same is true in our life. We want a restored life. We want a clean life. But in order to do that, we have to have somebody in charge. He says, you want Jerusalem to be back? You want it to be clean? You want it to be restored? Well, then you're going to have a good king in charge of it. And at the end of the day, if God is going to be the maker of our life, then God has to be in charge of our life. And so that's why the king is always attached to the new city. Because if the new city is going to be good, then they have to have a king that is good. And the thing is, we want a good life, and we still want to be the king. The problem is, we chose to be the king, and that's why our life is not the way that it should be. If we want our life to be restored, we have to allow God to be the king again. If he is not in charge, then his influence will not have the reign that it needs to have in order to have the impact that it needs to have. We want God to be the maker, and then we want him to set back and let us be the continuer. We want us to be in charge after he makes it new again. And it doesn't ever work that way. Remember all the way back in Jeremiah, last chapter, chapter 32, when he describes this new land, he says, they shall be my people and I will be their God. I will give them one heart and one way that they may fear me forever for the good of them and their children after them. If we want to be God's people, then God has to be our God. That's the way it works. That's why in the Lord's Prayer, when he describes how you communicate with God, one of the things he tells us to say is, thy kingdom come, thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven. In order to have a proper relationship with God and to see the needs met in our life that we need to be met, we have to recognize that God is in charge and what he wants in heaven should be true in our life on earth. God still has to be in charge. He is the good ruler. Number four. And if that's true, he is the bringer of righteousness. He is the bringer of righteousness. This is a very interesting thing. I don't know if I wrote the verse out for you. Jeremiah chapter 23. Yeah, turn back to Jeremiah chapter 23 super fast. Just a couple pages back. Jeremiah chapter 23. A while back when he described this new land, I'm almost done. When he described this new city and this new land, he he talks about the king that's going to come. Jeremiah alludes to the Messiah several times, which is Christ. In Jeremiah chapter 23, he describes it in verse number 5 and 6. Now, I'm having you turn here because there's a contrast between here that I think is very interesting. Look at verse 5. "Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will raise unto David a righteous branch, and a king shall reign and prosper, and shall execute judgment and justice in the earth." Does that seem familiar? We just read that a minute ago in chapter 33. Look at verse 6. "In his days, Judah shall be saved, Israel shall dwell safely, and this is his name, whereby he shall be called the Lord our righteousness." Okay? So his name, the name of this new king, will be the Lord our righteousness. Now, go back to chapter 33. Go look at verse 16. Chapter 33, verse number 16. He's saying something very similar about Jerusalem being restored. And if they're going to be restored, they have to have a new king. And if they're going to have a king, he has to have authority over them. Look at verse 16. "In those days, Judah shall be saved, Jerusalem shall dwell safely, and this is the name wherewith she shall be called, the Lord our righteousness." Well, is it calling Jesus a girl? No. Because in that verse, he's not referring to the king that will be called the Lord our righteousness. He's referring to the city that will be called the Lord our righteousness. So back in chapter 23, he says Jerusalem's going to be restored. They're going to have a good king, and he will be our righteousness. And in chapter 33, he says, if we have that righteous king over us, then our city can be called the Lord is our righteousness. What does that mean? In order for the city to change its very fiber of its being, then we have to have a king who is righteous to reign over us. The presence of the righteous king is what makes the city righteous, not the city itself. In fact, Jerusalem sometimes in the Bible is called Sodom and Egypt, because when Jerusalem is left to itself, it becomes just like the worst of the world. But when Jerusalem allows the Lord to reign, that's when it becomes special. When we are left to ourselves, we are no more righteous than the rest of this world. But when God has his influence in our life, that is what makes us different. That's when we can be called by a new name. We can be a new creation. We can be called something that is completely different. Because in us, I gave you Romans chapter 7, Paul says, "For I know that's in me, that's in my flesh, dwelleth no good thing. For to will is present with me, but how to perform that which is good I find not." Good intentions does not necessarily breed a good result. Because if you don't have the resources, if you don't have the ability or the wisdom, then it doesn't mean that you're going to bring it about just because you have the intention to do so. And this world is filled with people who have the intention to make their lives righteous and we're failing at it. But our lives can only be called the Lord is our righteousness if our King is the Lord our righteousness. That's why he says in Galatians 2:20, "I'm crucified with Christ, nevertheless I live. I live. Yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. The life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. I do not frustrate the grace of God. If righteousness come by the law, then Christ is dead in vain." If I could be righteous by trying hard enough, then we don't need Jesus. But the thing is, we can't be righteous by trying hard enough. We do need Jesus. He is the bringer of righteousness. I'll give you the last one and then we'll be done. Number 5. He is the maker because he is the keeper of promises. He is the keeper of promises. I can trust that everything I said this morning is true because if God says it, he means it. And that's why he finishes this chapter this way. Look at verse 17. "For thus saith the Lord, David shall never want a man to sit upon the throne of the house of Israel. That king from David will come. Neither shall the priests, the Levites, want a man before me to offer burnt offerings, to kindle meat offerings, to do sacrifice continually. The word of the Lord came unto Jeremiah, saying, Thus saith the Lord, if ye can break my covenant of the day and my covenant of the night, that there should not be day and night in their season, then may also my covenant be broken with David my servant, that he should not have a son to reign upon his throne, and with the Levites, the priests, my ministers. As the host of heaven cannot be numbered, neither the sand of the sea measured, so will I multiply the seed of David, my servant, and the Levites that minister unto me. Moreover, the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah, saying, consider thou not what this people have spoken, saying, the two families which the Lord hath chosen, he hath even cast them off. Thus they have despised my people, that they should be no more a nation before them. But thus saith the Lord, if my covenant be not with day and night, and if I have made not appointed if I have not appointed the ordinances of heaven and earth, then will I cast away the seed of Jacob and David my servant, so that I will not take any of his seed to be rulers over the seed of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. For I will cause their captivity to return and have mercy on them. Long story short, all he says is this. God says, I will have my priests to minister to the people, the Levites. I will have my king from David, and they will rule. And right now, it seems that God's not going to keep his promises. But he says, if you can break my covenant and my promises with the way the world works, like the day and the night, if the sun comes up in the morning and the moon comes out at night, if everything else is continuing to function, then what I'm doing with Israel will also continue as I promised it to be. And you can trust it. Just because it doesn't look at today doesn't mean that I'm not capable to continue to keep my promises. And that's a very long and emphatic way of him simply saying, if I promise it, you can trust me. The same thing he says to us as his children. Look at 2 Timothy chapter 2. He says, it's a faithful saying, for if we are be dead with him, we shall also live with him. If we suffer with him, we shall also reign with him. If we deny him, he will also deny us. If we believe not, yet he abideth faithful, he cannot deny himself. He says, you know what? You might not necessarily get all of the rewards that you could. You might not necessarily get all the benefits that are available to you. Rather than suffering and reigning with him, you might deny him, and then you don't get those same rewards. But at the end of the day, when we are faithless, God is always faithful. And if that's even true when we're faithless, think of all that we can experience if we just keep his conditional promises as well. He promises not to throw us away. We're reserved for eternity. But he's also promised a lot of things. If you obey, then I will do. If you call, then I will answer. And there's so many promises he gives that we don't trust him enough, then we won't be able to experience them. If he's faithful to us even in our faithless moments, think of all the promises that we're missing out on because we're not choosing to trust him and obey. And he says to us in Jeremiah 33, I know it doesn't always look like it's possible. Especially Jeremiah's book, it would appear that it's not possible. But right in the middle of this book, he says, in spite of how bad we have been and how bad we have made things, God is still waiting to restore our life and make us special and make us a good testimony where the people can look at our life and say, I know where they came from, but look at all the good and prosperity that God has put into their life. What hath God wrought in their life? It says, we can be that once we recognize that God is the maker of it and not us.